.co.uk/musicnation to find your local event or listen.
Starting Friday the 2nd of March at 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
Hello, I'm John Shea, and this Sunday afternoon on BBC Radio 3 continues in a couple of minutes with Baroque music from Poland. That's in today's Early Music Show. Right now, at just after 1 o'clock, it's time for the latest BBC News, read by David Cornett.
The Syrian government is holding a national referendum on a new constitution as violence continues across the country. Opposition groups have dismissed the vote, organised by President Bashar al-Assad, as a farce and have called for a boycott. The city of Homs has come under fresh bombardment, with activist groups saying that at least 26 people have been killed so far today. The International Development Secretary, Andrew Mitchell, has warned that people trying to escape from Homs are being put in further danger by infiltrators posing as humanitarian workers with the Syrian Red Crescent organisation. Two wounded Western journalists remain trapped in the city. The wife of the Sunday Times photographer, Paul Conroy, has called on the British Embassy to forget the protocol and get him out. An Afghan police security officer is being hunted on suspicion of killing two American military advisers at the Interior Ministry in Kabul yesterday. The man, who's 25, fled after the shootings. His relatives in the city have been detained. The Afghan president, Hamid Karzai, has appeared on national television to appeal for calm following violent demonstrations over the burning of copies of the Quran at a US military base. 30 people have been killed and hundreds have been injured since the protests began 5 days ago. Nelson Mandela has been discharged from hospital after undergoing a surgical procedure yesterday for abdominal pain. The former president, who's 93, had a laparoscopy where tiny cameras are inserted through small incisions. Scotland's First Minister, Alex Salmond, has refused to confirm that he's chosen a date to hold a referendum on Scottish independence. The Scottish edition of The Sun on Sunday reported that plans were in place to hold the vote on Saturday the 18th of October in 2014. And the weather, many places will be dry and mild with sunny spells, but it'll be cloudier in northwestern parts with intermittent rain. More persistent rain and strengthening winds will reach the northwestern half of the UK by this evening. BBC News and weather at approaching 3 minutes past one.
From David Cornett. Music by Berlioz features in our Sunday concert in an hour's time, a single work, his dramatic symphony Romeo and Juliet. It's a period instrument performance by the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, conducted by Sir Mark Elder. That's our Sunday concert at 2 o'clock. Before that, here on BBC Radio 3, the Early Music Show. And today, the second of two programmes this weekend exploring music from Poland. Lucy Skeeping makes some discoveries from the 17th century Baroque.
Welcome to the show. The chances are you may not be all that familiar with the repertoire we're going to hear in this programme. The Baroque masters of, say, Germany and Italy are certainly well known these days, but the opportunity to hear the music of some of their counterparts in 17th and early 18th century Poland is relatively rare. The music we're going to hear was all recorded at St John Smith Square in London. Highlights from a concert in the Lufthansa Festival given by the Retrospect Ensemble. Six singers, strings and a couple of trumpeters, directed from the keyboard by Matthew Halls. And as well as items from that concert, I'm delighted to be joined by Adrian Thomas, an authority on the music of Poland, who's going to guide us through this still little known repertoire. But let's start with some music. A short instrumental piece by Adam Jarzembski, a composer who worked for the Elector of Brandenburg in Berlin, visited Italy and spent the rest of his life as a member of the Royal Chapel in Warsaw. This is his Canzon Quinta.
Thank you.
The Retrospect Ensemble with Canzon Quinta, a five-part string piece from the Polish Baroque composer Adam Jarzembski, and we'll be hearing another of his pieces later on. Well, with me is Adrian Thomas, who's going to help guide us through some of the music we're hearing. Now, the word Baroque is Italian, of course, so what did the Baroque mean to Poland musically?
I think one has to fill in a little bit about the historical background to what's going on in Poland in the 17th and 18th century before one can actually get to the music. It was centred around Kraków right through the Renaissance period. Kraków was the capital, it was the trade centre, it was where the Jagiellonian University was founded, etc. And the golden age of Polish music for many people is the 16th century, particularly the second half of the 16th century. So when we come to the turn at 1600, like many other countries, they were in a state of flux. But in Poland in particular, their method of government and therefore of patronage also was changing. The centre moved from Kraków to Warsaw. The king went to Warsaw. His royal orchestra went to Warsaw. He employed Italian musicians specially for his new centre in Warsaw. So with that in mind, if we think what Baroque might mean for the Poles, it means shifts, it means changes of context, it means courts and chapels having an increased role in sponsoring and having their own court orchestras, their own chapels, if you wish. The Baroque was an exploration of a new world. It went in tandem with what was going on in Central Europe, particularly in Germany, but also with Italy.
Were things as sophisticated, though, in Poland as other parts of Europe? I mean, did Polish music travel?
It certainly was sophisticated because a number of composers went abroad. And, for example, Zieliński, whom we're going to hear in a moment, went to Italy. Jarzembski, whom we heard at the beginning, he also went abroad. And so, of course, they brought back the music that they heard and influenced what they were writing at home. It's not quite so easy to say that Polish music then travelled back abroad. I mean, this has been a centuries-long problem for the Poles, and it happened in the 19th century, it happened in the 20th century. We don't know very much about Polish music because the sheet music is virtually unobtainable in this country. CDs are virtually unobtainable in this country. Concerts like the one we're listening to today are rather rare. So throughout Polish history, there's been a sort of isolationist aspect to its culture, which we're still fighting against.
Now, you mentioned a moment ago Mikołaj Zieliński. What do we know about him?
We know relatively little. And this, I'm afraid, is this is quite typical of quite a few composers of this period. What we do know was that he was an organist and he directed the chapel of the Primate of Poland at a place called Wawicz, which is in the centre of Poland. And the Primate during that time was a man called Wojciech Baranowski. He was a great music lover. And he actually funded the publication in Venice in 1611 of Zieliński's Offertoria and Communiones. So it's reasonable to assume that he studied in Italy, that he knew the music of Palestrina, he certainly knew the music of Andrea and Giovanni Gabrieli, the polychoral tradition that was developing. Somebody once called him the most perfect Venetian in Poland. And these two collections, the Offertoria and the Communiones, consist of several dozen pieces, very noble, very resonant, impressive pieces. And Domus Meo is one of his concertante motets for four voices.
Oh,
Domus Mea by the Polish Baroque composer Mikołaj Zieleński, a highlight from the concert given at St John Smith Square by the Retrospect Ensemble directed by Matthew Halls. Now, Adrian Thomas, our next Polish composer, comes from a little later on. He was working in the 1690s, I think. And his name is Stanisław Sylwester Szarzyński. Tell us a little about him.
Well, again, this is somebody about whom we know very little. We know that he was a Cistercian monk. We know that he was probably connected with the primate's seat in Wawrzyc, like Zieleński was, mainly because most of his manuscripts, the few that have survived, are there. And he is primarily known for his choral music. He, for example, wrote the earliest Christmas carol known in Poland, a Motetto de Natividade, and he's written some motets and solo concertata motets like Years of Space Mayer. This is a really interesting one. There are two really fascinating aspects to this. One is that it uses for its melody a hymn that would have been known to the congregation. And it's a song for the dead. It's called Przez Czystsawe Upalenia, which means through purgatory fires. And the full text of the first verse, for example, says, through purgatorial fires which take away the sins, shedding tears without consolation, they beg your mercy, O Mary. Now, the tune is originally in 4-4 time. And he puts it into 3-4 time. He changes the emphasis from the first note to the third note. And more than that, what he's doing with it is to shift it. So, for example, just to get technical for a moment, the first verse, as sung by the soprano, consists of a 4-bar phrase, a 4-bar phrase, and a 5-bar phrase. And then when it's repeated with the instruments joining in, that sort of fluidity of overlapping bar lengths is continued. And for me, it is an absolutely wonderful piece, no more specially than the extraordinary end, which just fades away to absolutely nothing. It's terribly moving. Thank you.
the sacred motet Jesus Spes Mea, Jesus My Hope, by Stanisław Sylwester Szarzyński. The soprano there was Ildikó Allen, with the retrospect ensemble directed by Matthew Halls. Now, Adrian, like all the composers whose music we're hearing today, Szarzyński was from Poland. Now, is there a specific feature which you could say makes it sound Polish?
No, I'm afraid one can't really find that. There are occasional examples, but they're very occasional in this period, when you might get a sense of a violin figuration that seems to be more folk-like. You might find a dance rhythm here and there, maybe it's like Polonaise rhythm or it's like mazurka rhythm, but it's really quite minimal. And this is a big contrast with the Renaissance period, when that sort of influence was very present. And also in the Renaissance period, they used to set texts by Polish poets. This completely disappeared in the Baroque, so we have either Italian as opera, which was very popular in Warsaw in the 1620s and 30s and 40s, or you have Latin texts for the sacred music. So no, we're looking at something that is more generic across Europe through the use of language.
Well, we're going to return now to Jarzembski, who we heard at the beginning of the programme. Tell us something about his music. I mean, how much of it survives?
Well, again, here's somebody who has less than three dozen pieces surviving, 27 to be precise. And we know the date of most of them because there was a copy kept of them made in 1627. It was kept in Wrocław in southwest Poland until the Second World War, when it was destroyed during the war. He's a really interesting man. As you said at the top of the program, he was a violinist. He went to Italy. He was actually the king's architect in Warsaw in 1635. And he even wrote a little book called A Souvenir, or a short description of Warsaw, a thing in rhymed verse, where he talks about the buildings and the musical life, the royal chapel and so forth. So he was a man of many, many parts. He's a true Renaissance man. And of course, we're talking about somebody who flourished just as the Renaissance was disappearing over the horizon. So we're talking about somebody who is not a composer of choral or vocal music, but of instrumental music. He wrote some characteristic pieces with names like Berlinese and Königsberger and Nuremberger, place names, of course, and some with character names, Tamburetta and this one, Chromatica. And this is the one that I've known for longest. It's the one that I keep coming back to, mainly because of its extraordinary middle section.
It is marvellous, isn't it? Because it begins so innocently and you just think it's a little dance. And
yes,
then it suddenly kind of goes crazy.
Absolutely. I mean, it's so sprightly and I'm reminded of Gabrieli and early 17th century Italian music. And suddenly we get this dark, madrigalian, maybe operatic. I keep expecting somebody to say oime in the middle of it. It has this sort of weeping quality. And of course, Gesualdo died in 1613, which was a couple of years before Jarzembski went to Italy. He would have known Monteverdi's first six books of madrigals, for example. So you can see where it's coming from. But this is purely instrumental, and a wonderful piece it is.
Chromatica by Adam Jastrzębski, and rightly named. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Lucy Skeeping, and we're hearing highlights today from a concert of Polish Baroque music given by the Retrospect Ensemble, recorded at last year's Lufthansa Festival in London. And my guest is the writer and academic Adrian Thomas, who's an authority on Polish music. Now, our next piece, Adrian, features trumpets. In fact, it's got quite a sort of fanfare style, I thought, although it also does have this Venetian opera feel to it, you could say, as well. Tell us who the composer is and what we know about him.
Well, if you were reading this with an English accent, you'd say the composer's name was Damian Stachowicz, but in fact it's Damian Stachowicz, and he lived in the second half of the 17th century, born in 1658, died in 1699, one of the few composers we know the actual dates for. He died in Wawicz, the seat of the Primus of Poland. He was a Piarist monk, and the Piarists came to Poland in 1642, and he became a professor of rhetoric and poetics at the order's colleges around Poland, including Warsaw. We only have about a dozen or so of his pieces, not all of them in complete form. There's a lovely motet called Beata Nobis Gaudia. There are the typical psalms of the period, Beatus Vir, Laudate Pueri, and Dixit Dominus, and there's a litany of the Virgin Mary and so forth. This piece, Veni Consolator, is, as you say, rather special because of its use of trumpet. Now, he was very fond, apparently, of the trumpet, because a number of his pieces have one or more. As you also rightly point out, it seems to be almost secular in its tone.
So let's hear this motet, Veni Consolator, by Stachowicz. Come, Redeemer, to thee we cry in our misery. Veni Consolator, a motet by Damian Stachowicz, a monastic composer working in Poland in the second half of the 17th century. And that was the soprano Julie Cooper with the Retrospect Ensemble. So time now to hear the longest work in today's programme, and it's by arguably the most important figure of the Polish Baroque, Grzegorz Gwazy-Goczycki. Adrian, it's said that he represents the golden age of Polish music, so why is he considered to be so important?
Well, he's important for a number of reasons. First of all, we know quite a lot about him. He was a composer, he was a priest. He studied in Kraków, he was educated further in Prague, and he got a doctorate at the University of Vienna. He came back, he became a curate on staff of Vábor Cathedral in 1694, and 4 years later he assumed directorship of the chapel, the Kapellmeister there, until his death in 1734. And his last major duty was to provide the music for the coronation of August the 3rd in that year. So he was at the centre of Kraków music. Now, we come back to this idea that the royal court was in Warsaw, but somehow the old school was in the wonderful Vábor Cathedral on that mound at Kraków. The reason why he's important musically, I think, is because he's a synthesis. He's a synthesis of the old and the new. Now, given the fact that he was writing when he was, that's to say, mainly in the first couple of decades of the 18th century, 1700, 1710, 1720, 1730, it's extraordinary that he should be harking back to the 16th century, to the Stile Antico and to Palestrina. And yet, he's also combining that Stile Antico with the Stile Moderno, writing that we've heard already in the programme. And the Completorium is a huge piece in some ways. I mean, it's almost 25 minutes long. It's got seven movements. And in those seven movements, we have all of the elements we've heard elsewhere in the programme today. We have wonderful instrumental writing. We have psalms. The core of the Completorium is this wonderful hymn, Te Lucis Antiterminum, which is sustained and reflective in its first half and is a complete contrast to the vigour and the joy and the exuberance, if you like, of the writing in the other movements. In some ways, the Completorium, which incidentally was only discovered 50 years ago, nobody knew anything about it until around 1961. This is where we're struggling with Polish music, that it simply has not been available, and so it's all new to us as well as to the Poles.
Before we hear it, perhaps it'd be worth putting it a little more in context. What was the Completorium for? I mean, what's it about?
This was a title that was used by a number of composers at this period, and in this particular instance, it's a combination of texts that monks would have used when they were singing Vespers in the cathedral in Wawel, praying for protection at night. That's what it's essentially for. And what Gorczycki has done is to make a ceremonial piece out of it, if you like, a concert piece out of it, even though it is essentially sacred music.
Well, thanks very much, Adrian. Looking forward to hearing the piece in a moment. Perhaps before we let you go, finally, can you sum up in some way Poland's contribution to Baroque music in general?
Well, isn't this a hard one? As we've discovered today, we're dealing with a relatively small repertoire, simply because most of it has been destroyed in wars and sackings and all this sort of thing. What I can say is that we've had the privilege of listening to pieces by five different composers, but there are many more out there. Two others, for example, one might talk about is Bartłomiej Pękiel, and the other is Marcin Mielczewski, both of them in the second part of the Baroque period, and they are absolutely superb. So if anybody is listening to this music and they think they want to investigate more, there are other composers out there waiting to be discovered.
Thank you very much indeed, Adrian Thomas, for joining us. So, here now is the group Retrospect with Gorczycki's Completorium, the text chanted by Catholic monks to pray for divine protection during the night. I will lay me down in peace and sleep, for thou, Lord, makest me dwell in safety. The epic Completorium, based on the Vespers Prayer, by the late 17th, early 18th century Polish composer and director of music at Wawel Cathedral, Grzegorz Gewazy-Guczycki. The performers were the Retrospect Ensemble, directed by Matthew Halls, part of their concert given in last year's Lufthansa Festival of Baroque Music.
And that ends today's Early Music Show. It was presented by Lucy Skeeping and produced in Salford by Chris Wines.
On BBC Radio 3, the National Ensemble plays Brahms. This week on BBC Radio 3, I'll be introducing four concerts from LSO St. Luke's as the National Ensemble pairs major chamber works by Brahms with works by Mendelssohn, Strauss, Mozart and Haydn. Join me, Katie Derham, for Brahms with the National Ensemble, starting this Tuesday lunchtime on BBC Radio 3 at 1 o'clock.
Well, that's from Tuesday onwards, but tomorrow, Monday, as ever, we'll be live at the Wigmore Hall for our lunchtime concert. Nikolai Lugansky is the pianist playing Liszt, Wagner and Rachmaninoff. His first piano sonata completes the programme. That's tomorrow, Monday, just after 1 o'clock. This is BBC Radio 3. This Sunday afternoon, it's just after 2 o'clock and time for our Sunday concert. It was recorded last weekend in London and it's introduced by Catherine Bott.
Welcome to the Royal Festival Hall, where we're going to hear a dramatic symphony by Berlioz in which he pays homage to his two great mentors, Beethoven and Shakespeare. Assembling on the platform now are the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, and they'll shortly be joined by solo singers Patricia Barden, John Mark Ainsley and Orlin Anastasov, with conductor Mark Elder, to perform Romeo et Juliette. We'll also hear a great deal from the BBC Symphony Chorus and Schola Cantorum. When Hector Berlioz came to Paris in 1821, he'd never heard the sound of an orchestra, but he was eager to learn everything he could about music and the arts, and over the next few years he devoured French culture. Then, in a short space of time, he discovered the plays of Shakespeare and the symphonies of Beethoven. In 1827, he saw the English actors Charles Kemble and Harriet Smithson in Romeo and Juliet, and was bowled over not only by the play, but also by its leading actress, who became his idée fixe and eventually his wife. Years later, the Illustrated London News claimed that Berlioz had said on leaving the theatre, "I shall marry that woman and write my grandest symphony on the play." But Berlioz denied any such grandiloquence, saying that he'd been too overwhelmed even to dream of such things. Besides, he said, "Music has wings too wide to spread fully within the theatre." So 12 years after that dumbfounding Shakespearean encounter, when he came to set the tragedy of Romeo and Juliet to music, Berlioz didn't write an opera, but looked instead to the magnificent dramatic possibilities of the symphony. It was really Beethoven's Ninth, the choral symphony, that sparked off the idea that anything was possible with the symphonic form, even the retelling of a famous play. Berlioz foresaw the criticism and misunderstanding that his creation would provoke. With a touch of irony, he wrote in the preface to Romeo and Juliet that there will doubtless be no mistake as to the genre of this work. Although voices are frequently employed, it is neither a concert opera nor a cantata, but a choral symphony. Berlioz was right to be pessimistic. The work seems to have languished under a cloud of willful misinterpretation for decades. Earlier today, I spoke to the great Berlioz scholar, David Cairns, and I began by asking him why Romeo et Juliet still gets misunderstood.
I think it's because people think this isn't a symphony and therefore we shouldn't do it. But it doesn't seem to me that what you call it really matters. And actually, if you look at it, which a lot of the early critics never bothered to do, if you look at it, the scheme of the work very carefully, you see how thought out it is and how beautifully constructed it is in such a way that the choral finale will come out of everything that has happened before.
What about the role that the soloists and the singers play in this choral symphony? Do we have a Romeo and Juliet? I don't think we do.
No,
do we?
Because I think he realised, I mean, he had been thinking possibly in terms of writing a Romeo opera, but the state of the Paris opera where it would have been performed was so terrible. He said, you can't imagine how music is dragged through the mud there. He realised that an orchestra, the post-Beethoven orchestra, which had revealed to him and to Wagner how incredibly expressive and subtle an instrument the symphony orchestra was, this orchestra had made him realise that the best way he could represent this impassioned, sort of pure first love was by instruments and not by fallible singers with all their egos and all that sort of thing.
How important to this performance is the use of period instruments, the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment?
Very. I mean, as long as one doesn't think that it rules out performances of the work by modern symphony orchestras, I think it's terribly important because the colours spring out at you. And the ball scene with all the sort of syncopated orchestral colours, they spring out at you in the most extraordinary way. It really does enhance. And also in Queen Mab, it enhances the fantastic orchestral writing there.
David Cairns, whose pre-concert talk was standing room only. Despite his reverence for Shakespeare, Berlioz believed that the love between Romeo and Juliet in the stage play could be even more powerfully expressed in music without words. So although he wrote solo parts for mezzo-soprano, tenor and baritone, we'll hear them rather as Mercutio or Fra Lawrence, or singing more generally about the joys of first love. The French text is by Émile Deschamps, after Shakespeare. It's the orchestra and chorus who bring us the specifics of street brawls, sword fights, masked balls and balcony scenes in Verona. Berlioz even divides the chorus into warring contingents of Capulets and Montagues. and he lays out the whole story of the play in a tapestry of instrumental, choral and solo vocal music over seven movements, beginning with an orchestral introduction evoking those two feuding families, and ending with a choral finale which describes the end of years of hatred brought about by the deaths of Romeo and Juliet. The work will be sung in French and performed without an interval. Now Verona comes to London's South Bank as Mark Elder and the soloists arrive. He's going to conduct the dramatic symphony of Romeo and Juliet by Berlioz.